The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week's show is all about insects. We'll talk to entomology blogger Bug Girl about her favorite species and the bugs that may be lurking in some of your most cherished food products. But first, let's find out about the ways that different cultures view insects as food, from snacks to delicacies to being completely grossed out by the thought of putting them anywhere near our mouths. Enjoy. I'm talking today with Greg Layden, biological anthropologist and author of Greg Layden's blog, Culture as Science, Science as Culture. As always, great to have you back, sir.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So let's talk about the eating of bugs on purpose. How many societies do it?
That's actually a good question. I don't know the answer to that. It's pretty common, and I think it's something that we see more often in certain parts of the world than others. It may be more often tropical. It's something hunter-gatherers do, generally speaking, who live in areas where there are quote-unquote bugs to eat. I don't think the Inuit or Eskimo eat a lot, but people in the Amazon and Central Africa do. So I actually don't know what percentage of societies do. That's also a hard thing to measure because it depends on how you count societies. There are 700 different Bantu-speaking groups in Africa. Are they really 700 different groups, or would you count that as sort of three or four major groups? So it's probably not something we know. But I think it's widespread. I think a lot of people eat insects on purpose.
Well, I assume that different societies, if we can sort of semi-define that word, do it for different reasons. Like there's a difference between eating bugs for survival and eating them because they're considered a delicacy.
Yeah, I think so. And I think part of it is when you think about eating insects, you have to kind of think about what kind of food is it. For example, with the Fa pygmies that I worked with in Central Africa, when they hunt, if they do something that they call hunting, they are hunting for mammals and reptiles and birds. They eat a lot of insects, but they don't call the getting of insects, that process, they don't refer to that as hunting, even though insects are animals. When they go to get honey, they call that hunting.
Interesting.
They hunt for honey. And by the way, when you eat honey, you're eating a lot of bee larvae and adult bees. Besides the incidental parts, like the various arms and legs and stuff, or whatever, legs and antenna, that is in there, you're intentionally eating the larva from the comb, and the person who gets the honey will take great relish in eating the queen. So they're eating insects, but the process of getting honey is called hunting. But the word that they use for getting insects is the same that they would use for gathering vegetable matter and fruit and so on. So they gather insects normally.
Would the definition of bugs depend on culture as well?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, yeah, it's an interesting thing because we're talking about whether or not insects are part of your cuisine, if they're counted as food or not. And, you know, different societies have different ways that they categorize or classify things as to whether they're food. A famous anthropological story that I've actually seen happen to an anthropologist, but it's happened to many anthropologists, is you arrive somewhere and you ask them, what are your food taboos? And the way you might ask that, depending on the language, is, are there any foods that you don't eat? And the answer to the question, are there any foods you don't eat, is always no. Because why would it, or if you don't eat it, why would you call it a food? If you ask a person in a pluralistic society, a society where there's a lot of different kinds of people, if you ask a Jewish person, are there any foods you don't eat? They'll say, well, yeah, like, for example, pork, because they get that there are different people with different taboos. But if you go to a society in which there isn't that kind of overlap, and ask, are there any foods you don't eat? It's just a dumb sounding question. So, you know, whether or not something is included in your dietary list, in your cuisine, it, you know, that varies from society to society. There's different kinds of rules. There's kind of two ways in which things are classified. One is it food or not? And the other way is this particular thing, which may otherwise be a food, something I am personally prohibited from eating because I'm a menstruating female or I'm a member of a certain Patrick clan or I want to have good luck with fishing next week. And if you eat any mammals during the whole week before you go fishing, it doesn't work, you know, some kind of specific temporary thing or classificatory thing related to your role in culture or what you're doing versus just, is this food or not? And, you know, among people who eat insects, it isn't like they say, oh, we eat stuff including insects. It's just that among the list of things that they eat, there are some insects.
Is it mostly cultures that are living in poverty then?
That's a kind of a tough question because, you know, the Fa pygmies don't live in poverty at all. yet they don't have houses that are permanent.
Right. So maybe let's not say poverty, but use it as subsistence as opposed to considering it like a gourmet treat.
Oh, that's true. In most cases, insects are consumed as part of your diet because it's just part of your diet. It's subsistence. It's neither a gourmet treat nor a starvation food. In many different societies, there are things that are classified as starvation foods, things that you eat when there's nothing else to eat. And I can't think of any examples of a society in which insects are a typically used starvation food, although there probably are some. In fact, any society that encounters starvation, widespread starvation, will eat pretty much anything. We've heard stories several years back from people in North Korea who were eating, you know, grass and tree bark and so on. But a lot of societies have food that they eat regularly, but they're only eating when there's nothing else to eat. There's a couple of leafy plants that I can think of in the Aotearoa Forest that people really avoid eating, but they eat them when there's nothing else around. I don't know of any insects that fit that category. If anything, there's a slight tendency for insects to be classified as special or extra good in societies, like a bit like a delicacy, because they are rare. Usually the insects you're eating are relatively uncommon, and they're high-quality foods, meaning they're high in fat or nutrients, just like meat is considered to be a delicacy or high-quality food, even if you're eating it on a regular basis. So an interesting thing happened that it was a good example of a conflict between different societies and what they treat as food and not as food happened a few years back in the Aotearoa Forest when we were visited by a man who was claimed to be, by the people who sort of came ahead of him and said he was coming, as this quote-unquote king of the pygmies. And he was a pygmy man that as a baby, as an infant, was taken out of the Aotearoa Forest by Italian Catholic missionaries and brought to Italy. I don't know why he was taken. I assume he was an orphaned baby.
Right.
That's giving him the benefit of the doubt. It's probably still a bad idea to take a baby because a baby pygmy is not really orphaned because everyone takes care of each other's babies and you're just simply adopted. But anyway, they took this baby back to Italy and raised him up there as a pygmy living on Italian food in Rome. And so when he returned to the Aotearoa Forest as a 30-year-old man, he was the only obese pygmy that ever existed because pygmies live kind of on the edge in terms of their food supply. And their physique is such that their body fat is not distributed among their upper body at all. So the average pygmy has, you know, a six-pack and really well-defined muscles, and then the men are really well-built. So he shows up, and people were kind of concerned about this guy coming in being called a king, and that led to all kinds of interesting political dramas, and people were literally arrested. Some people were actually beaten, and it was a very, very nasty political mess because a person who might have had more power than the local villagers who was a pygmy showed up. But I asked my friends who are pygmies, what do we give some guy who says he's the king of the pygmies? And they said, well, we'll give him a delicacy. Well, what would that be? Well, termites. It's termite season. We can go out at night. The winged form of the termites leave their nest at night, and thousands flee the nest, one or two females followed by thousands of males, sort of like ants do. They fly towards the moon because that's the signal they use, so they end up more or less in the right place in the sky above the nest to mate. So you go out with a lamp of some kind and a basket, and you hold the lamp behind the basket, and the termites fly into the basket, and you capture them. And then they're a delicacy. So we got a basket of these termites. And, of course, this is a man who didn't even speak the local language. He was practically born in Italy. He spoke Italian, and he was raised on European food, and we gave him the insects. And he was reasonably polite but had no interest in them at all. He kind of gave them to someone else. It was kind of an interesting example because there's a nice conflict between cultures as to what people find acceptable and what people find special. And in this case, the termites were considered to be relatively special as a delicacy, not because they were extremely rare or even that good tasting. It's just you only get them now and then.
Right.
And somebody who saw that as something that you would never even consider eating.
Marcel Dick did a fantastic, in my opinion, TED Talk on why we should be introducing bugs into our diet. And it was mainly for environmental and practical high protein reasons. Now, is something like that at all likely to catch on in our society, especially being that Westerners have a fairly solid ew response to things like that?
That's a good question, because any kind of behavior or practice of any kind could be found by one society to be something that was repulsive in another society to be normal. But these things that surround food are usually extreme. Usually people are sickened by the idea of eating something that is in their own culture taboo. Losing taboos does happen. I mean, there's lots of people who were whose ancestors, whose parents were raised as kosher Jews who enjoy a BLT. Their parents would be literally sickened by that idea. So taboos can be removed, but in this context, in a Western context, we're talking about taboos for things like pork that are embedded within a larger society that eats pork.
Mm-hmm.
Like Homer Simpson once said, you know, the magical animal that produces bacon, ham, and pork chops. But insects are so completely outside of our range of activities. We don't. There's no one else in a grocery store who's buying insects. A vegetarian goes to a restaurant and there's meat on the menu, and that's okay, but there aren't insects on the menu that you're just deciding not to eat. So the kind of background there of introducing it would be very difficult, I think. I think that there are lots of insects in our diet now. We eat insects all the time because if you take a point on the landscape and pass a gazillion tons of plant food through that as it's processed, corn, wheat, rice, whatever, insects are going to show up and consume that stuff, and they're going to end up becoming part of our food supply. And one way to do this might be to start admitting overtly how much our food supply already includes insects. It's probably a percent or two. It's probably a few percent of our grains that we eat in the form of insect matter now. If that was kind of more or less admitted, maybe people would start to just take it for granted that we're already eating insects and they could be included in their diet. One of the best examples of kind of use, economic use of insects that I can think of from the Aturi is the local locust. It's actually a katydid, and during the rice harvest season, it arrives in large numbers to eat the rice, and it hatches in the Sudan and flies into the central rainforest and eats all the rice. And in some years, it can be very damaging to your crops, and they're totally edible. You sit there at night with a fire, and they are flying around, and they fly into the fire like moths do and cook themselves. You don't even have to cook them. They cook themselves. And you just pick them out of the fire as they're kind of writhing around. And they taste really nutty. Like if you made a candy bar out of them, it'd be like a Reese's peanut butter cup kind of flavor. They're really good. A little chocolate on them would be great. And of course, they're getting a twofer because they're killing some of these insects, although a tiny percentage of them. They're feeling good about killing the insects because that's actually part of the enjoyment of eating them. Because you know the next day they're going to come and eat your livelihood.
So it's revenge. It's preemptive revenge.
It's revenge eating. And then it's additionally, they're actually, I'm presuming like other insects, insects that are not poisonous are generally basically nutritious or just as good as eating any other kind of animal product.
Honestly, I really, really want to try eating one of those massive cooked beetle things that I keep seeing in documentaries. Have you by any chance eaten one of those?
No. I've only eaten tiny beetles. We've had infestations by beetles of our food in the Aturi forest, and that's where you're eating, for example, maybe 10% of the mass of the beans that we're eating was made of beetles that nest in beans. These were tiny, small enough to kind of pretend they aren't there and just ignore them. The half-dead katydids sounds kind of extreme, but once you start eating them, it's like they're like potato chips. You can't stop. They're just so good. And you know, and that may be what happens. You're asking the question, can Americans or Westerners start eating insects? Whenever you talk about eating insects, people bring out the giant roasted beetles.
Right.
a commenter on my blog pointed out, who's a friend of mine who's now in China, has talked about the scorpions on the sticks. She wants to go down to the market tomorrow and get some. Maybe it's better to start with something a little bit less scary that people might actually think about eating. There was a time in the 60s, and I was a little kid, I only barely remember this, but there was a time when chocolate-covered ants had become kind of a craze.
And I tried those.
Yeah.
Those were great. And they're like Rice Krispies.
It's just a mass of chocolate. There's like an ant in there somewhere. You can barely tell. Maybe some kind of tipping point could be reached where insects are introduced as a kind of a fad diet item, and they just happen to be good, and people just happen to like them, and then they start eating them. Of course, then that would raise conflict, obviously, with existing agricultural industries. If the insects could be something that could be siphoned off of that, you know, where they are now in the food supply, instead of producing cornmeal, you produce insect-rich cornmeal by just reducing the regulations telling you how much insect you could have in there. Yeah, there's probably a way that you could get Cargill and other big companies to put some money into this.
But really, the first point would be to try to convince people that eating insects was a good idea for any reason.
Right. That they want to eat insects because, like, I'm convinced that being a vegetarian is a good idea.
You're not a vegetarian, are you, Greg?
No, I'm not. But I'm glad that there are people who are vegetarians, and I fully support them in their activities. And I'm very happy also to eat less meat. I mean, I consciously think about how much meat I'm eating. I make a point of it. If there were insects in the market that I could add to my diet, having eaten insects before, and it's always been interesting and often, I got to tell you, I like the katydids and I like palm grubs, but I just don't like the taste of termites that much. I just don't. I mean, they're not bad, but they're not my favorite. But you know, you would expect it. You expect with the diversity of insects that some would, you would like some and not like others. But I could easily include them in my diet. And I'm just thinking, how would I myself get my family to go along with that? Who have been to Africa, by the way, but haven't necessarily encountered insect eating there.
My son is grossed out just by me having this conversation. So thanks very much for being here, Greg.
Thanks. It's been fun.
You can find Greg Layden at scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden or at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with entomologist Bug Girl after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at speak73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Bug Girl. She has a PhD in entomology, and her research involves using pheromones to try to control insect populations without pesticides. She writes at Bug Girl's blog, and she's currently employed at a large university at an undisclosed location in Connecticut. Welcome, Bug.
Hello.
Now, you are not the first blogger with a pseudonym that I've had on the show. The lovely Cy Curious, who I invite on as often as I can, is in the same mysterious position. So why do you blog under Bug Girl? Are insects that contentious?
You would be surprised. I have been surprised. Basically, I work for a state. And so once you reach a certain pay grade or trophic level in the state and you control a certain percentage of the budget, when you say things using your real name, it can have policy implications. And in the place where I previously lived, Michigan, they actually have a law that prohibits state employees from speaking out publicly about any state policies, which could include things that involve agriculture, which, of course, involves insects. And I ran into some trouble there because I basically had been using a pseudonym, but even that they weren't happy with. So even as a blue woman with antennae, I couldn't express opinions about agricultural policy. And so I'm in a new place now, but I still, again, am bound by contracts for the state. And it's a common problem for civil servants. Just this week, there was someone who worked for a health department that was basically shut down by his employer and told not to use his real name because, again, it reflect upon the state-funded agency.
Well, I do want to talk about bugs because that is absolutely why you're here, but I'd also like to talk very briefly about your experience with Google Plus before we get going.
Yeah, they kicked me off. They've kicked a lot of people off. And interestingly, because I think women are far more likely to use a pseudonym, I mean, I initially started blogging under a pseudonym eons ago, back when it was still called a weblog. And that was mainly because I had a stalker and I didn't want to be found. And so the policy that makes you reveal your identity is one that is going to disproportionately affect women, and in particular women that have had, I guess I would say, bad experiences or for whatever reason don't want to make themselves easy to find. And if your name doesn't look normal, then there is a little robot that trolls around on Google Plus and suspends your account. And at this point, Google is pretty much everywhere. So suddenly losing access to all your Google services is kind of a big deal. And they have, for the most part now, stopped cutting people off from their Gmail. But many of their other services, there's so many other things that it's really a hassle to be disconnected. And it's been a major problem. And it's right now there's a lot of data that suggests that membership on Google Plus is about, the last one I saw was 80% male, which is pretty disproportionate, especially when, in general, women tend to dominate social media. If you look at Twitter, it's almost flipped the other way. It's more like 70% right. female. So something is going on, and I frankly think that something is that women tend to use pseudonyms, and they now view this as a not welcoming place. And certainly statements by some of the higher-ups have said, we don't care, which is kind of surprising. But I think what they're wanting is they feel that behavior will improve if everyone used their real name. And the problem is there really isn't data that backs that up. But there isn't data that disproves it either. Because you can find communities where people use pseudonyms and people behave well, and you can find communities where people use their real names and they behave terribly. The only thing that's really constant and that there seems to be any data on is that you have to enforce good behavior. And so if there are penalties for behaving badly, whether it's with your real name or if you're imaginary blue woman with antennae, if there are penalties and consequences, then people will behave better online.
But as you said, you've been writing under Bug Girl for years. And so for all intents and purposes, that is your name online. So how does that affect you and other scientists who want to blog under a pseudonym?
It's a major issue. And science blogs just recently also said we will no longer support pseudonymous blogs. It's a major issue because if you are successful, I've been really lucky and privileged to rise to a fairly high level, and that now suddenly means I can't talk anymore as myself. Many of the other people who are young scientists feel like they can't use their real names because they still have to get tenure, and so they are concerned about that process. And a surprising number of the science bloggers that use pseudonyms work for the National Institute of Health or are funded through the National Institute of Health in the U.S. And are concerned very much about, you know, again, they're civil servants, and they want to be able to talk about important issues of how health policy is made and how the research, you know, implicates policy. But it's getting harder and harder for people to do that.
Okay, so that's troubling to say the least. So on to your favorite bugs.
Yes.
So this is a hell of a segue, really.
Give me a couple minutes. I'll come up with something good. Oh, I got it. We were talking about pointy-headed academics, and now we should talk about pointy-headed bugs.
I think I love you. So we're starting out with tree hoppers, then. Tell
yes.
us about them.
Tree hoppers are definitely my favorites. That's actually what the domain name of my blog is, Mimbracid, and that's Mimbracidae is this little group. And they really are insects with pointy heads. They have things on their head that make Princess Beatrice's wedding hat look blasé. I mean, they have things that you could wear to Ascot or a royal wedding easily. There's like little pawn shop balls. There's points. There's bifurcated horns. I mean, just all sorts of different kinds of crazy things on their heads. And most of them are about maybe 5 millimeters. In Canada, right? You guys are metric. You use the real system. Excellent. That's good because I do terribly translating back and forth between inches and metric. So they're tiny little things, but when you look at them, they're really amazing. And they're probably on all of your plants, but you never see them because they're masters of disguise. They look like little leaves. They look like – some of them look like bird poop. They look like thorns. They look like leaf buds. So they're very tiny and very good at hiding, but when you look at them closely, they're really fascinating.
So all of these pointy-headed hat-like things, what are they for?
Nobody knows. There's a lot of theories about it, but at the moment we just don't know. We're still trying to figure it out. We did have a big jump forward in figuring out how they came to be, but the why I think is going to take quite a bit longer. The theory that I like the best, mostly because it kind of plays into my whole there's a secret world in your backyard that you don't know about theme, is that it somehow initially, anyway, was related to sound perception. Because the other neat thing that treehoppers do is they actually vibrate and transmit songs through the body of plants. And it's really amazing. I've listened to recordings of it, and it makes me think of whale song. It's just sort of this really eerie, vibrating, woo sort of pattern. And so it would kind of make sense that if you have a big resonating chamber stuck on the top of your head and you're communicating by vibration, that maybe that would be a helpful thing. The other thing, it's very clear that the points on their head and thorns and other sorts of things, many of those extensions are clearly for camouflage. And they make them look that much more like a plant or a piece of poop or whatever they're particularly mimicking. And then there's also, we don't know. We can speculate, but at this point, we don't know. What we do know is that the way that they got these points is pretty amazing, because insects are only supposed to have two pairs of wings. If you look at an ancestral insect, or things that are in fossils, they look a lot like sort of a millipede or a centipede. So every single segment has legs, and almost all the segments are exactly the same. And then as things became more insecty, you see that they're actually losing those legs, and some of those extensions became other things. So some of the legs in the front ended up becoming elaborate antennae or mouth parts, and some of the extensions in the back became, well, you know, party in the rear. So these modifications, once they got set in the basic pattern, it's pretty much they have a head, they have a thorax, they have an abdomen, and all of the thorax, they have six legs, and then they have two sets of wings. But it appears that somehow the tree hoppers had activated this dormant gene sequence, and the things that their pointy heads are made out of are not actually wings, but they're homologous to it, so they're controlled by similar genes. And it's really an amazing thing that kind of shows how the new molecular science is really revolutionizing the way that we understand the world around us. And it ultimately boils down to a Hox gene, which I don't know if you've discussed before, but basically regulatory genes. In your body, each of your cells has all the same genes, but somehow your body knows that your liver should go on the inside and your nose should go on the outside. So there's switches that turn things on and off. And it's that on-off switch that is being changed in these insects so that they have this bizarre extension that grows out. They actually tested this, which was also really cool, by doing a little gene jockeying. And they basically played around with a caterpillar that is a very distant relative, but they took the gene sequence that they were interested in, that on-off switch, and they flipped the switch on, and they actually got wing tissue to develop on a caterpillar in a place where it really shouldn't have. So it's, we have a really clear idea of, wow, this is how you get amazing new forms out of the same old genetic information. And it's a really neat way of showing that evolution can take existing material and modify it radically in ways that we wouldn't have predicted.
You wrote an entire blog post on this, and it was very accessible, so I encourage people to go look at that, and we will link to it on the website. But I do have to read something that you wrote, because I thought that this was a particularly succinct way to explain this. How does your body know the genitals only go in one specific spot during development? Why doesn't it build a scrotum on your head like a jaunty beret? I thought that was a fantastic question, really. That's all you
know,
got, eh? Nothing.
Amazing.
All right.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that we could figure out ways to build our bodies better. But for the most part, when things get turned on inappropriately, it is not good. In this case, it worked out okay.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about Bug Girl's favorite insects and what they can teach us. Now let's talk about pollinators. Now, when we think about pollinators, bees are what usually comes to mind, but that would be incorrect.
Not fully correct, yeah. And what people mostly think of are honeybees. And honeybees in North America are actually an introduced species. So they're sort of like kudzu, or I can't think of a Canadian introduced species, sorry. I'm from the South.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually have invaded and driven out a lot of our native species. The honeybees themselves, they're like cows. They're kept in little, very tiny barns, and they're fed and they're cared for, and they're moved from place to place, and they do a job. They do a pollination job. And we're finding out now that, you know, hundreds of years of inbreeding and having them maybe have not a very good diet, then there's been all sorts of other things that have come along and attacked honeybees. They're definitely having some issues. And so there's a lot more interest in trying to save our native pollinators that have always been here and that basically keep the rest of the ecosystem functioning and that can also do almost as good a job or in some cases better a job than the introduced species of honeybees.
Well, maybe for all those people who are driving in their cars right now and listening to this, can you explain the pollination process? Because a lot of us don't remember high school science.
A lot of times, at least in the U.S., they teach pollination and they say bees pollinate things and it's good. But what they don't actually say is, and pollination is sex, because that's what it is. If you have allergies to pine pollen, that's because you have Christmas tree sperm up your nose.
Pollen See, this would have sperm. Made those classes far more interesting.
They never let me teach this. I have no idea why. So essentially, what bees are is a sexual surrogate for a plant. Plants, you know, they're stuck in one spot and they have to have some way to move their gametes around. And sperm, basically, that's the pollen. You can throw it into the wind, and that's pretty much what pine trees do and what corn does. But the majority of plants on Earth, about 70%, rely on a pollinator, either an insect or some other animal, to move their pollen around for them. So basically, they're sort of like little flying phalluses. You could kind of think of them that way. And if you don't get the pollen moved from plant to plant, then you don't get any fruit. You don't get nuts. You don't get all of the things that we really like to eat. In the United States, the value of pollination per year, $3 billion in crops.
And what kind of crops are we talking about?
Mostly fruits and seeds, things like blueberries, strawberries. Cranberries are actually more pollinated by native bees. Things like almonds, pecans. You would be amazed. There's actually a whole book of all of the things that are pollinated by insects.
And so it's also the things that are dependent on the food that are pollinated by insects that we're worried about.
Yes. And we have many, many of our native species are becoming endangered or just completely disappearing. And when we already have our honeybees in trouble, there's no backup. The bench is empty. And so there's a program that the Xerces Society is promoting, and I want to definitely plug the Xerces Society because they have literally hundreds of free publications that you can download online that will basically tell you native plants that you can grow in your area that will provide food for the pollinators around you. A lot of what we've done as humans is, in addition to just paving over things that bees might have been eating, we plant really showy foreign plants. And they aren't necessarily things that the native bees can eat or that are nutritionally appropriate for them. And so trying to think about, you know, what are you planting? Where are you planting it? Providing habitat for the native bees. All of those things will give you, first of all, a better vegetable garden, but also try and keep those species around so that if, in fact, you know, the honeybees do start getting even weaker than they already are, we've got our bench full of, I wanted to think of a hockey metaphor, but I got nothing.
You are a kind and generous overlord. Beautiful.
Can't come up with anything. We need thousands of little tiny Gretzky's.
Oh, you are speaking to my country. So, you know, every once in a while we hear about colony collapse disorder. So what exactly is that? And do we know why it's caused?
We more or less know, but knowing and proving are two different things. And again, this is something that is only affecting the honeybees. Although, unfortunately, there's some evidence that some of the things that are affecting honeybees are also spilling over onto our native bees as well. So honeybees have a lot of things going against them. One of the things that they have that's really problematic is a varroa mite. And these are parasitic mites that get on the bees, and you can see them. They're pretty big. And so it would sort of be like having a really small cat attached to you, sucking blood off of you, to sort of a size comparison. So they're fairly large, and you get too many of these on them, they're just, you're not going to feel good. Then there's tracheal mites. So these are mites that get in the bee's respiratory system. So now you've got little things crawling around inside you. Then there's viruses. Let's see, it's the Israeli acute paralysis virus, I believe is what it is. So there's that virus. And then we have fungal diseases. So there's all of these things that are attacking the poor bee's immune system. And on top of that, we frequently take them to a place and set them down. So I'll stick with blueberries because I've worked with blueberries a fair amount. So we take our colonies of honeybees and we put them in the middle of a field of blueberries. And then that's the only thing they have to eat. If you only ate one thing for months on end, would you be healthy? Probably not. Especially if, like me, your one item that you chose would be your favorite Ben & Jerry's flavor. So there's all of these things that are going on with the bees. And the amazing thing to me is that normal losses for honeybees over the winter are 30%. If a farmer lost 30% of his cows every winter, we would pay attention to that. So there's always been a tremendous die-off in honeybees. Now we're getting die-offs even higher, up into the 50, 60%. Of losses. So it's a very serious problem, but it's very intermittent. And I think we still have a couple more years to go before we really get a handle on it. We do know things that are not killing bees. Cell phones, not killing bees.
Thank you.
The data on pesticides, for now anyway, does not suggest that some pesticides that have been implicated are also related. It's probably not helping, but it's not causally related. It's one of many, many other insults that bees have to deal with. So there's a lot of, I don't want to say crackpot theories, but some of them are a little odd.
Right. and
it's really, a lot of it boils down to, this is an incredibly complex problem. You know, I've named off 6 or 7 different things that contribute to it. What we really want as people is we want a simple cause and effect relationship. That makes things so much easier when there's one gun and one bullet and one body, and there's no smoking gun. There's like 20 smoking guns. And so it's very difficult for us to say for sure this is exactly what causes it when it's probably a combination of 6 or 7 different things. And the way that that gets reported, for the most part, at least down here, is, oh my God, the bees are dying. We're all going to die.
There's a lot of that, really.
There's a lot of chicken littling all over because you have to get eyeballs. Sadly, entomology has very few explosions. So, you know, we have to do something to get attention. And pointing out that they're important for the food supply is good, but it, sometimes it comes back and bites you.
We have a question via email from Mindy.
What do you think of the idea that colonies of ants or bees compete with each other in the same way that individual organisms compete for survival?
I think she's probably talking about the superorganism hypothesis. So the whole idea of how colonies survive is actually in the middle of this giant upheaval. And there are people who are sort of back and forthing and calling names. And within academia, it's pretty much a, you know, sharks and jets throwdown. People are arguing that there is kin selection, there isn't kin selection. It is a superorganism. It isn't a superorganism. So at the moment, since I am not a specialist in that field, I'm just going to say jury's still out. And that's true of a lot of things because there are so many insects and their lives are so complex that we know incredibly little about them. I mean, the membrasids, we only just discovered that they had songs and they had this communication system like maybe 10 years ago. But people have been studying these insects for hundreds of years. So we've really only just begun to scratch the surface of explaining how bugs do all the cool stuff that they do.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today we're talking to entomologist and blogger Bug Girl. So bugs are good for more than teaching us about evolution or pollinating things, which are both lovely. But it turns out we eat them too. Now, Greg Layden told us about why some societies find that disgusting, but maybe you could tell us about the various ways that we eat them that we might not know about.
I hate to tell you this, but there's probably lots of insects in your coffee and chocolate, both of which do have some pollination that has to occur in order to get coffee and chocolate. So right there, that makes them important. But in the U.S., anyway, we have specific levels that are set of how much stuff can be in your food that isn't actually food. And so for chocolate, you can have 60 or more insect fragments per 100 grams of chocolate.
Wow.
You will never know. In coffee beans, they basically only measure the beans, not the ground coffee, mm-hmm. because honestly, you don't want to know. But for coffee beans, 10% of them can be insect infested.
You know, it would take a lot more than that to turn me off coffee. Considerably
yeah, me
more.
Too. Well, I mean, it's all roasted brown, you know, who cares?
I'm not going to know. Now, that's the sort of safe level for coffee and chocolate. But what is that compared to other foods?
Well, that's actually not safe.
Oh.
There is no harmful level. It is only aesthetic.
Interesting.
And that is the way the FDA sets the rule. It says on it, straight aesthetic. So it's not a safety issue at all. It's simply that if you have more than that many particles, then people start freaking out. And ultimately, that's one of the things that I've tried to sort of repeat over and over is we really have an incredible expectation of perfection in our food and in our food supply. And at least for Americans, we're kind of obsessed with things being really clean and really sterile. And that is not how life works. Life is dirty. Life is filthy. There's poop. You know, it's not reality. And the problem is the more perfect we demand that our food be, the more processed and the more chemically processed it has to be. And so being willing to accept an ear of corn that maybe has a little nibble on it, being willing to accept an apple that is not perfect, and they actually put chemicals on apples to make them have the right shape.
Right.
So our demands have consequences, and basically, bugs happen.
That's interesting because, okay, so there's the aesthetically pleasing / safe in other circumstances level, but there's also bugs that we purposely put in food.
Right.
So,
right.
Shellac.
Yes, shellac is a really wonderful little insect. It's surprisingly, many of the insects that we eat that we don't know that we're eating are scale insects. And scale insects are these freaky little insects. They look like Jabba the Hutt. Except much, much smaller.
Can I just point out that you have the best metaphors? I christen you queen of the metaphor.
Okay, that's good.
Good. Let's move on.
So you have this tiny, tiny little Jabba the Hutt that's about the size of a head of a pin. And they live on a plant. They kind of look like plant pimples. And all they do, it's just a mouth part and a bag. And they just suck juice out of the plant. And that's all they do. And they have an earlier stage that are called crawlers, that's basically a mouth, a bag, and legs that runs around and finds new spots to suck juice out of the plant. Because they're pretty vulnerable, because, you know, if you're a big bag full of sugary water, things are going to want to eat you. A lot of the scale insects have a variety of different weird coverings. And so shellac is made from the lac insect. And they have these amazing little varnishes that they cover themselves with. It's actually a waxy secretion that they produce. And that protects them pretty well, except that at some point humans figured out, hey, we can take this stuff and we can boil it down and we can make shellac and we can make jewelry out of it. We can make a varnish out of it. We can do all sorts of really cool things with it. And so right now, one of the most common uses of shellac is actually in confectionery products because it makes your food shiny. So colored sprinkles very often have shellac in them. They tend to not call it shellac because then you could look at the label and go, oh my God, there's a bug in it. So it's basically usually called confectioner's glaze. And confectioner's glaze, if you see that in a product, it almost always means that it has some bug secretions in it. It doesn't have bug bodies. It has bug secretions.
Everybody is going to be checking the ingredients list on their candy from now on.
You know, if you're at Tim Hortons, you're having a donut, right? It's got chocolate and sprinkles. Are you really going to care about whether, you know, something on it has is secreted by an insect? You're eating something that has 10,000 calories.
Just try to translate that into Canadian for us?
Yeah. Hey, they have Tim Hortons in Michigan.
You're practically Canadian. That's fine.
UPA from Escanaba.
So how about, and I'm going to mangle this word, cochineal?
Cochineal is actually another, this one is bug juice, but not necessarily bodies. The bodies all get filtered out. But it's the thing that these two insects really share is they both are ways for people who live on a very subsistence economy to make some cash. The shellac is harvested mostly in very rural India, where it's a way for communities to be able to make some money. And cochineal is native to Central America. And basically, for many years, it was the primary red dye that was used in food. And it's the same thing. It's a scale insect. And they produce this compound that makes them this incredible, beautiful, deep pinky red. And the red dye itself, there's a wonderful book about the whole development of red dyes. But for many, many years, it was the only source of red dye that humans had. And the thing that cracks me up is that whole, the American thing about, oh, the red coats are coming. It was actually, oh, the slightly pinkish coats are coming because they were dyed with cochineal dye, which is very pinky. So it's sort of like a, you know, the light rose red coats are coming.
So how would that be listed on a list of ingredients then, if it was to be?
Well, at this point, because people have figured out, oh my God, it's an insect, it's actually been withdrawn from a lot of things. So you used to find it in grapefruit juice, you used to find it in Campari, you used to find it in yogurt, and it's actually been withdrawn from most of those. So it's typically labeled as carmine or carminic acid. Sometimes they also can call it, it's got an EU number. But the place that you almost certainly will find it is in your lipstick and blush. So you almost certainly are spreading smashed insects on your lips if you're using a pinkish lipstick.
I don't wear lipstick.
Anymore.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to tell you more things that maybe you didn't want to know about bugs after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll look at the microscopic organisms that share our environment. Science writer and blogger Carl Zimmer joins us to discuss his new book, A Planet of Viruses. He'll explain how viruses run the world and the uneasy truce we've reached with the real rulers of our planet. And journalist Maren McKenna tells us about her new book, Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. Find out what makes antibiotic-resistant staph so scary and what researchers are trying to do about it. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is the pseudonymed bug girl, entomologist, and science blogger. So I do believe that we have established that insects are often awesome, but I think that we can all agree that mosquitoes are often not. So do those ultrasonic mosquito repellers work by chance?
No, they do not. No. There's probably more hokum in the service of repelling insects than anything else. It's pretty amazing. You can actually even download an app for your iPhone that claims to repel insects through ultrasound.
They get up our hopes and then they send them crashing to the ground, really.
And this is something that I get pretty serious about because, one of the things I posted about today was the West Nile virus has been found in almost every county in New York. It's a major issue, and there are some very serious human health consequences to not repelling mosquitoes and not protecting yourself. Before I get too deep into this, I want to point out that the vast majority of mosquitoes don't bite people. It really sucks to be a bird. Most mosquitoes seem to really like sucking on bird blood. And so there's only a few of them that attack us, but unfortunately they also carry a lot of diseases.
Right.
Yeah, the ultrasound is so crazy. It just kind of reduces me to just going...
How is it supposed to work in the first place? Let's start there.
Well, that's the best part because it really depends on which one you buy. So some of them say it's mimicking the wing beat of a dragonfly. And so mosquitoes hear that and they run away. Some of them say it's mimicking the wing beat of a male mosquito and that drives females away because it's only female mosquitoes that bite. That one has always baffled me because if females run away from male mosquitoes, why are there still mosquitoes? But
Apparently, that's a fantastic question.
Yes, apparently that little logic has not prevented them from selling lots and lots of devices. And then there's another one that just is sort of like the same principle as the ultrasound in the malls that supposedly drives away teenagers. That's just an unpleasant sound and they go away. And these things have been around since the 70s and they have been tested consistently. And there is absolutely no data at all that support that those sounds will drive away mosquitoes of any species that they have been tested on to date. So the other part, of course, is I don't even know if an iPhone can produce an ultrasonic sound, but if it did, it still wouldn't work. The things that attract mosquitoes to us are so incredibly idiosyncratic, and this is another place where we're really starting to make some progress and really cracking the code of what makes some people incredibly attractive to mosquitoes and other people's not attractive. And it's that incredible variation. I mean, I am a huge mosquito magnet, but my sister can't get a mosquito to bite her. And this obviously has risen to some sibling issues. But so there's this incredible range. And what happens is there's these different devices, and there's so many things that people suggest. You know, grind up grapefruit and put it on your head, or take B vitamins, or take a lot of garlic. Because there's this incredible range of variation for those sort of folk tales about what repels things, is they'll work for some people because some people aren't that attractive to mosquitoes, and then you get a confirmation bias.
Right.
So, you know, oh, I thought it was going to work. It did work. And I remember that. But I forget all the other times when I did something and it didn't work. So there isn't any evidence either for garlic, B vitamins. There is a new thing that's just come out that is, in fact, derived from grapefruits. But that's a compound from grapefruits that's been synthesized and concentrated. That's not the same as taking your breakfast grapefruit and just sort of dabbing it behind your ears. So there's differences there.
Noted.
We have a question from the chat room from Greg Layden.
Do people really get bitten by spiders while they sleep as frequently as they claim? Or are those bad bites just very effective mosquito feeding events?
Well, I think there are a lot of different things. Brown recluses get blamed for everything. But when you look at the actual range of where brown recluses really are, they're actually only in a couple of states in the U.S. So all of these other people that claim to be getting bitten by a lot of these horrible venomous spiders, that I don't know what bit them or if anything bit them, but it probably wasn't a brown recluse. And it probably, more often than not, is just our own skin. Skin is an incredibly huge and complex organ. And it's really easy. We come up against so many different things in the environment that, you know, you'll wake up, you'll find a bruise. I don't know about you. I wake up, I've got a bruise, and I'm like, what'd I do? I don't know. It's kind of the same thing. You wake up, you've got like a big itchy spot. What did you do? Well, it could have been a mosquito. It could have been your cat scratched you. It could have been there was something on the sheet. It could have been a million things. And unless you actually see a spider bite you, it probably wasn't a spider. Because they're not going to be hanging out where you are unless you're covered with insects. They're going to be up in a corner somewhere or by a light or somewhere else where there's a snack. People are not attractive to spiders. They run away from us. So unless you're actively poking it, for the most part, spiders leave you alone.
Now, we are very near the end of the show, and I realize I have a bunch of audience questions here, so let's get to some of those. This is from Emily.
Is it true that there may be as many species of insects on the planet as there are actual people? How do we estimate how many species there are if we haven't counted them all?
Ah, that's a good one. We know right now that there are 1 million species of insects that have been identified. So that's not as many as people. We estimate that there are probably 30 million species total, which I should say is about 70% of all animal species. So more kinds of insects than anything else. Still, that's not the same as the human population, but if you want to know how many individual insects, estimates are around 10 quintillion. And I had to look this up. That's 10 to the 18. So 1 billion is 10 to the 9, ninth power. So I think it's fairly safe to say that in terms of how many insects there are, a lot more. So how do we know this? There are surveys that people do where they basically go somewhere and kill everything and then count it.
Good times. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, entomologists know how to party. So basically, the estimates are pretty amazing. Things like in the top 5 inches of soil, 425 million insects per acre.
That is vaguely disturbing.
It works out in general to be about 300, 400 pounds of insects for every human on Earth.
Okay, let's move on to the next one, and I won't think about that for very long. This one is from Lester.
I always hear that cockroaches could survive a nuclear war. But aren't they adapted to tropical or temperate climates? Wouldn't global nuclear winter be really bad for them, even if the radiation didn't hurt them?
Well, that gets into the whole, will there be a global nuclear winter, which I'm not going to touch. But I can talk about radiation.
Right.
So this is one of those tropes that's sort of been around and gets repeated a lot. And I think, honestly, people like it because it fits our image of a cockroach as evil.
Interesting.
And indestructible. We like to hate cockroaches. And the sad thing is, cockroaches actually are pretty cool. They have a social organization. Some of them have parental care. They're pretty complex animals. But if they're in your Wheaties, you don't really care. So when you look at radiation and insects, what you find is that insects are pretty resistant to radiation. They're about 20 times more resistant than we are. And that makes sense because all insects have that really hard exoskeleton. And so that would be a pretty natural barrier to some of the radiation. But when you compare how much radiation different insects can take and cockroaches are actually pretty wussy. Fruit flies can handle a lot more radiation than cockroaches. But I think the giant 50s movies have sort of cemented the whole radiation giant insect thing in our mind. And I think it just makes a nicer story to think that cockroaches are evil and we can't get rid of them because no one can get rid of them even with a nuclear bomb.
Spoken like a true insect lover. And we have time for one more question, and this is from the chat, and it's from Roxy.
Many friends of mine are afraid of spiders. Is there anything I can say to them other than, they eat flies, you should like them?
This is something I struggle with a lot because obviously, and I think Greg addressed some of this, there's some people have major issues with insects and spiders. The thing that I have found that works the best is to simply hand them a spider. Obviously, not everybody has a big tarantula that they could just whip out and go, here, hold Fred. But getting someone up close to an insect or a spider where they can really see it and look at it, they're amazing things. I mean, jumping spiders are really cute. And they have sort of shiny claws that are kind of a bonus. But you have to get down and look at them closely. And all insects, really, if you look at them closely, they're amazing. You can't change everybody, but getting them to come to a, you know, live and let live, that's a win as far as I'm concerned.
And with that, we are completely out of time. Bug Girl, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks. That was fun.
You can find Bug Girl's blog through the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, do keep clicking to our Facebook page, to Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desert ray shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics. And their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams. The charlatan who, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus. Eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desert ray shell, gonna raise a little hell. Metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.